Once in a while, the events of a single day can change the course of history. In my lifetime, one such day stands out above all others. It was June 6, 1944, D-Day. The forces of Adolf Hitler's Nazi Germany had overrun most of Western Europe, enslaving, murdering millions of people. Paris was occupied. London and the British Isles were threatened. The only way to win the war was to drive Hitler's armies back to Germany. To do so, the American and British allies had to get back onto the European continent. The D-Day operation was a massive landing on the Normandy coast of northern France. It began with this message to the troops from their commander.
This is the last alerting announcement from Supreme Headquarters, Allied Expeditionary Force. General Dwight D. Eisenhower.
Soldiers, sailors, and airmen of the Allied Expeditionary Force, you are about to embark upon the great crusade toward which we have striven these many months. The eyes of the world are upon you. The hopes and prayers of liberty-loving people everywhere march with you. In company with our brave allies and brothers in arms on other fronts, you will bring about the destruction of the German war machine, the elimination of Nazi tyranny over the oppressed peoples of Europe, and security for ourselves in a free world. Your task will not be an easy one. Your enemy is well-trained, well-equipped, and battle-hardened. He will fight savagely. I have full confidence in your courage, devotion to duty, and skill in battle. We will accept nothing less than full victory.
Thousands of the men who heard that message would soon lose their lives. But by the end of this pivotal day, the Allied forces were in the process of taking those vital Normandy beaches, codenamed Gold, Juno, Sword, Utah, and Omaha. Over the following months, the Allies marched inland from their precious footholds on the coast until Hitler and the Nazis finally were vanquished. 20 years later, I had one of the great privileges of my life. I went to England and to Normandy with General Eisenhower for a look back at the valiant invasion that had changed history. We started at Southwick House near Portsmouth, England. On D-Day, the war room inside that building had been the most secret place in the Allied world, the nerve center from which General Eisenhower commanded the Allied Expeditionary Force. The original invasion map had been preserved, just as it looked on the morning of June 6, 1944.
General, when in the planning did Normandy first come into the picture as the site?
Well, the detailed planning started long about the fall of 1943 and was under charge of a man named Morgan, General Fred Morgan of the British Army. And it took months of planning, and he was in many ways the father of the plan that was executed here, the start being on D-Day.
And what about the date? When was that first chosen?
Well, there was first of all, the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the two governments, the Western governments, had told Generalissimo Stalin that we would attack in May. So we began to examine the weather, and we had to have a particular combination of tides, light, and moon. And this was showed that you had about a few days in June where you could have the perfect conditions, or nearly perfect conditions, and a few days in May. We'd like to have gone on the 5th of May. But to get the breadth of attack we thought necessary, we had to wait until June. Now, the ideal days were from June 4th, 5th was the ideal day, but 4th was satisfactory, 5th, 6th, and 7th, and even possibly 8th. But that would have been stretching a little bit. Now, I picked June 5th as the best. And we came down here hoping and praying that the weather would be sufficiently good we could go on the June 5th.
Well, General Eisenhower, June 4th was the day when you had to make the decision to go on June the 5th.
That is correct.
What happened on that day, June 4th?
Early on the morning of June 4th, I came from my camp about a mile from here, came into this room. And Captain Stagg, who was the chief meteorologist for the Allied forces, he was supported by two or three Americans, a couple other Britishers. But he made the presentations. That morning, the stars were out, it looked beautiful, and he gave us the worst report you ever saw. And he talked about gales hitting the Normandy beaches, and winds up to, the rate of 45 miles an hour, that kind of thing. Landing would be impossible. So I just said, all right, we have to postpone. So we postponed for 24 hours.
There wasn't any question of going the 5th. I mean, none of your commanders said,
advised
going.
I believe Montgomery said he was ready to go. But it didn't. The conditions were such that I knew. We'd had our troubles down in the Casablanca beach when you got surf pretty high. We also had had some in Sicily. So it was it wasn't in the cards. You couldn't go.
So you stood down on the 4th.
That's right, and that was the weather when we did that looked so lovely. But in the morning of the 5th, Walter, here's the big thing. Morning of the 5th, I came over here. The weather was terrible. This house was shaking. Now, you know, this, you said, well, there's no use almost of looking at this thing again, but this one thing about it, it certainly increased my confidence in Captain Stagg and his crowd, because the 24 hours earlier, when it looked so bad, so nice, they said, this is what you're going to have, and we had it. Oh, it was really storming.
At the height of that storm, the forecasters were predicting yet another turn in the weather, a good turn that would allow the Allied forces to land the following morning, June 6th.
As I remember, he predicted this good weather would last between 24 and 36 hours. Now, that wasn't too good, because you could get so many troops ashore and then have to stop landing, and it'd be pretty bad. But we were trying for these, these artificial ports, and we hoped that with this break, we could do it. It was still a chancy thing. But when he gave it and said that the waves now on the beaches were not going to be more than 3 feet or something of that kind, and the wind was going down, there'd be some opportunity for bombing, and the gunfire from the naval ships could be spotted pretty well. I thought it was just the best of a bad bargain, so I possibly sat silently just reviewing these things, maybe, I'd say 35 or 45 seconds. Now it's been reported by some of the people present, for example, my own chief staff says that 5 minutes. Well, I know that one, but 5 minutes under such conditions sounds like a year. Actually, I'd think after 30, 45 seconds, something like that, I just got up and said, okay, we'll go, and this room was emptied in 2 seconds.
Well, after you made your decision, what were you thinking of during those 45 seconds?
Well, I think just reviewing briefly all of the possibilities you had for a success and what would be the penalties not only of failure, of making a bad decision if you were too rash, on the other hand, the penalties of not making a decision and saying we'll wait some more. And I think that I just reviewed them in my mind and said I thought the best opportunity now. We were given sort of a God-given opportunity in this little space of good weather, of which the Germans knew nothing, it turned out later, and I said yes.
Now, this was at approximately 4:15 in the morning of June the 5th. You had about 20 hours to wait before the first airborne troops went in, and 26 hours before the ground forces hit the beach. What did you do during all those hours of waiting?
Well, of course, that's the most terrible time for the senior commander. He's done all that he can do, all the planning, and matter of fact, there's very little more that any commander below, above division command can do anything after once you get started. So the first thing I did, I went over and fortified myself with a lot of coffee and breakfast. Then I began to go up and down the wharves. Some of the ships were still starting out, and I saw people that had sent them off and so on. And I came up here during the middle of the day to see if any news coming out, and I kept pretty close to my communication center. And then finally, along about 6 in the evening, I went over to a field from which the airborne, the American airborne, started out. Now, I couldn't go to all these fields because there were many of them. But I did go into the 101st Division, and it was a very fine experience. They were getting ready, and all camouflaged, and their faces blackened and all this. And there they saw me, and of course they'd recognize me. And they said, now quit worrying, General. We'll take care of this thing for you. And that kind of thing was a good feeling. As they started off, I watched them out of sight. Then it took me a couple hours to get back to my headquarters.
One of the most famous pictures of D-Day was of you talking to the paratroopers in their camouflage. And one of the versions of that visit, I think, said that as you turned away, this reporter saw a tear in your eye.
Well, I don't know about that. It could have been possible because, look, here's the kind of an operation you start. You know there are going to be losses along the line. They're going to be bad because we knew this. They were mobile troops, German troops in that area. There was all sorts of flak, they call, you know, anti-aircraft stuff. And there could easily have been fighters coming into these helpless troop carriers. It's a, I would think, if a man didn't show a bit of emotion, it would show that he probably was a little bit inhuman. And goodness knows, those fellows meant a lot to me. And you just had to make these decisions on the bay when you're in war. I'm going to do something that will be to my country's advantage for the least cost. You can't say without cost. You know they're going to lose them.
Well, now, in the selection of Normandy as opposed to the Pas-de-Calais area where the crossing was much shorter and so forth, was the surprise element of Normandy the principal factor in making that decision, or were there other factors?
Well, yes, that was one. Now, although, strangely enough, Hitler, with all his intuition, did have one good guess, but he never thought it was good enough that he would order the main defense to be made in Normandy. We knew, of course, you could not keep the Germans from knowing that great things were afoot. We had to try to surprise him on location and timing. And then timing, not only in the general timing, but if possible, in the time of day. In any way that you could would surprise him, that was all to our benefit.
How do you think we succeeded so well in keeping the secret of the location and the day?
Well, of course, extreme measures were taken. When we started to move the troops south to get to their embarkation places, we just pinned them up, and we wouldn't let them out. There was no running around in the villages around here. The people down in these cages, you might say, you couldn't call them anything else because they were fenced in, they were crowded up, and everybody was unhappy, and worse than this. We went so far that we stopped all diplomatic exchanges from the embassies of the world with London, and this was embarrassing to their government, but they were sturdy. They stuck right by it. We did everything to keep any information going out, and on top of that, we did a lot to confuse the enemy. We put phantom armies, and we put radios and things with phantom messages going back and forth all the time between a Army group commander and his new outfits. Well, to show you how we succeeded, Mr. Speidel, or General Speidel of the German Army, who was the chief of staff to Rommel, in writing his book 5 years later, he said, we wondered why the Allies didn't use very quickly their 75 divisions. We didn't have 75 divisions. We had about, I think it was 35 in all England, or all Britain, including the Canadian, the British, and one Polish, and I think a French, and all of our own. And in more than that, the Germans kept those horses back in the Pas-de-Calais. They kept all those divisions when we were fighting in Normandy because they still believed the main attack was coming over Pas-de-Calais. So our deception measures worked well.
General Eisenhower, what was your greatest concern on D-Day? What worried you most?
Well, more than anything else, the airdrop, particularly the airdrop in the Cotentin Peninsula. We thought that it was necessary because Here is the Utah beach down here. Right here really is where the landing spot. Behind that was a big lagoon that had been constructed by the Germans. Over that lagoon, which was a deep one, were just several exits, and only three of them were usable. Now, we felt unless we had some of the paratroopers to come and get the exits of that lagoon, these people here might be pinned down and then Bosch artillery and mortars and so on just pound them to pieces and the thing would be done, just no good. This attack, first of all, was just going to be this. Now we wanted to widen it to get this in here and to get Cherbourg more quickly and to spread the defenses. Well, Air Chief Marshal Lee Mallory, very courageous man, had made up his mind that this area in here, which had been reinforced with mobile troops and which had a lot of flak, and particularly along the coastlines, would just be probably too tough for the air, the paratroopers to get in there. But we had done the best we could, and with General Bradley and General Ridgway, Ridgway being the senior paratrooper of the Americans, we decided that it ought to go on anyway, and we needed it going if we were going to have this attack go in. Well, Lee Mallory accepted it for the moment, but he came back, and he was so sure we were making a bad error that about a day or two before the attack, he came to see me down in my camp down here. And he just, he was really earnest in his recommendations. We must not do it. Well, I went back to my trailer by myself and refused. There was no use for any more experts on this thing. And I went on this theory that this attack without this was not a good gamble. From the beginning, we'd all agreed on that. Now, we had to make some adjustments of where they were going in because the Germans had been reinforcing in here. But there was a little town in here, San Mary Glise, and that was to be captured. These exits, and then to protect our left flank as we came in here, why, that was the mission of the paratroopers. Now, although they had some high losses, they were nothing like Lee Mallory had feared they'd be. And by the way, I had a message, I think something about 2:30 or 3 in the morning, that they landed. And when he found out things were going pretty well, very early in the morning, he called me up, and you never heard a man so enthusiastic. Oh, he said, "I'm sorry I made your burden stronger." He really was a top flight fellow. Unfortunately, he was killed before the war was over.
General Eisenhower, I gather that at one point you wrote a message that you prepared to send if there was disaster on the beaches.
Well, Walter, I must tell you something. I did, and I don't know exactly who found out about it, but it was published. What I did was this. From the beginning, I had been partly responsible for this. I had been the staff, the head of the staff, that originally outlined this operation way back 2 years ago. From all those 2 years, I'd believed on this thing. I believed it would defeat Germany, and consequently, I felt a not only as a commander, but as sort of a fellow who'd been trying to convert everybody to the need of this thing, I felt a particular responsibility. So I wrote a little thing that said, we assumed that we were going to be defeated, but I told no one else about it, and it must have been an aide that got this thing out and told people about it. I just said, the landing has been a failure, and it's no one's fault but mine. I was the one that picked out the... I knew it couldn't fail except on weather. I was the one responsible for the decision to go, and all the fault belongs to me, and that's that. Because if it did fail, you know this, I was going into oblivion anyway, so I might as well take full responsibility.
From the war room at Southwark House, General Eisenhower drove to the Royal Naval Yard at Portsmouth, where he received a warm and grateful welcome. From there, we boarded the British frigate HMS Gurkha to retrace the trip the general took shortly after the Allied forces landed across the channel to Normandy.
General, this harbor of Portsmouth must have been absolutely crammed with ships on that morning.
Oh, it was. I came down here both on June the 5th and then June the 6th. Some of the follow-up, the people were still here, but on June 5th, it was jammed. And you see, the ship was delayed, and so on. These ships were all crowded. I came in here and talked to the men. And we had, I told them it'd be all right. That's all you could say. But it was an awful letdown. They'd been crowded on the ship already for some hours.
General, there must have been a lot of men, I suppose, who wished they weren't here that morning, but backed up there, too, there must have been an awful lot of men who wished they were aboard, who wanted to be aboard.
Well, that's right. That's right. Well, of course, all the people had been trained. They thought it was their duty, it was their job. But, of course, no one likes to be shot at too much. But I must say, there was more people that wanted in than those that said, well, now we want to get off.
One of those who wanted to go but was left behind was the Prime Minister, Winston Churchill himself, wasn't he?
Yes. He wanted to come, and he told me of his intention to come. And I told him he couldn't do it. I was Commander-in-Chief of this operation, and I wasn't going to risk him because he was worth too much to the Allied cause. Well, he thought a moment, and he said, General, he said, do you have the operational command of all of these forces? I said, yes, that's right. But he said, but you are not responsible for, administratively, for the makeup of the crews. And I said, no, that's right. He said, well, then, he said, I can sign on as a member of the crew of one of His Majesty's ships, and there's nothing that you could do. And I said, that's correct. But Winston, you will make my burden a lot heavier by doing it. So we left it there. Well, luckily, the king learned of his intention. So the king just sent word and said, well, as long as the prime minister feels it desirable to go along on this operation, he said, I think that I should, it'd be my duty now to go along with you. So he sent word to the prime minister. He alone also would be. Well, of course, the prime minister didn't want to take any chances of the king, so he didn't go. That's the way it stopped. He was a staunch old fighter, that fellow.
He was opposed to this operation, though, for a while, wasn't he?
Well, for a long time. You know, in the last briefing we had, I think it was about May 15th, we'll say, he used an expression that the Americans thought rather odd. He said, I'm hardening toward this enterprise. Well, this meant to us that he was beginning to become more confident of his success. But of course, you must remember this. The British had visions of their experience in World War I, of getting on the ground fighting in France, and you had Vimy Ridge and Passchendaele and all of those other terrible battles where you would lose a couple of 100,000 men and not gain a foot, or at least not gain any mileage. So I think it was only natural that he should be cautious about authorizing or giving his blessing to an operation where that might happen. And I told him that we were coming ashore equipped to make this a war, one of a movement.
It would be the greatest armada of all time. Churchill had warned the Allies that the operation would be costly.
1944 will see the greatest sacrifice of life by the British and American armies. Battles far larger and more costly than Waterloo or Gettysburg will be fought. Sorrow will come to many homes in the United Kingdom and throughout the Great Republic. British and American manhood, striving in generous emulation, true brothers in arms, will attack and grapple with the deadly foe.
President Franklin Delano Roosevelt led the American people in prayer.
Almighty God, our sons, pride of our nation, this day have set upon a mighty endeavor. They will need thy blessings. Their road will be long and hard. Help us to conquer the apostles of greed and racial arrogances. Lead us to the saving of our country, and with our sister nations into a world unity that will spell a sure peace. Thy will be done, Almighty God.
As they sailed through the pre-dawn darkness from England to the landing areas in France, the Allied vessels had to make their way past dangerous German minefields in the middle of the English Channel. 20 years later, as General Eisenhower scanned the Normandy coast, he explained how difficult and treacherous it was to get the right units to the right places.
You see, we'd put our minesweepers in here to make sure that when we came in that we weren't going to be hurt and damaged by the mines. So we had all these minesweepers out ahead of us, that part of it. And here, on the this flat bank where the British were coming in, they did a very fine thing. They had a to guide these small boats in. When you come out 2 or 3, 4 miles, of course you can easily get lost in the dark and with very few landmarks. They put in these little bits of tiny submarines, which had to lay on the bottom during the day that the postponement taken place. But they came up when they knew the invasion was coming in. And they used lights to the stern, you know, or shielded lights, radio, and even visual flags to help these people get right into the right place. And over here, where the currents were so bad, this was very difficult over on the American beaches, and we had a great deal of trouble getting into the right places. But the men themselves took charge a great deal. But there's no question. Over in this one beach where all the fight took place, the naval gun support was really, became finally the decisive factor. It was just absolutely superb.
Were the naval losses about what were expected, or higher or less?
They were very, very few. Very few, and I think here and there one had a mine, hit a mine. Actually, the 4th Division, which hit Utah over here, was, they had only 200 men, yet in a practice cruise, a practice landing on the south of England, we lost 700 men out of that same division about a couple weeks earlier. The German PT boats sneaked in and without anyone knowing it, hit two LSTs. We lost 700 men, and we didn't even know it until the next day. I didn't have a report on it for 24 hours because it was just done so secretly. But, and if anyone had known it, there'd have been a lot of rescue. But these poor fellows just went down, and so.
What about the German Navy? It never appeared on D-Day.
Well, they was over here in, I think it was in Dover, no, up in Le Havre. They had a little bit of mosquito fleet, and they tried to come out and damage us a little on the left flank, but nothing happened of it too much.
Thanks to the U.S. then Army Air Force, having depleted the resources of the Luftwaffe over the years of heavy bombardment and so forth, you didn't have any trouble with the Luftwaffe, but do you think you could have made this landing without the air superiority that we'd achieved?
Oh, no. But you see, over these years, we'd not only knocked off the Luftwaffe, but we'd done this. Way back to as far as 200 or 300 miles, we'd taken every field that we could find and just pockmarked it. So it was unusable at the time. And then, of course, it was very bad weather. The German didn't believe that we could possibly land here. And so all in all, we had a day that was free of enemy interference, except that we met on the beach.
Pointe du Hoc is a large promontory just about midway between Omaha and Utah beaches. Behind its cliffs, the Germans had their heavy guns ready for anyone who might try to invade. As we stood at the summit of Pointe du Hoc, General Eisenhower described to me the daring operation that captured this important spot.
Well, this actually was a sort of an isolated but a very dramatic phase of the operation. Right on back on the back of where we are now, there had been spotted five large guns, and they were situated very well to shoot into the assembly areas where our unarmed transports would be unloading into the infantry and the small boats and so on, getting them in. These guns, though, could shoot 20,000 yards either way, and they were thought to be very, very dangerous, and that for naval bombardment, to take these fortified guns, you might say, and destroy them would be pretty much of a miracle if you could do that very quickly. So they worked out this Ranger program, and these Rangers, you know, are specially trained people. They're very hardy fellows, and they can do anything, mountains, swimming, swamps, everything. So they set three companies, the 2nd Ranger Battalion, to come up here as sort of an isolated part of the operation. They were supported by two destroyers out here with gunfire, and they started to climb this promontory. Unfortunately, you see a point out there?
Yeah.
The attack of the infantry was on the other side of that point, but in the dusk and the dark, the people bringing in the boats mistook that point for this one. And so they started to go there, but the Colonel Rudder, who was in command, finally discovered the mistake and got them over here. Well, this brought them in about 30 minutes late. Now, the plan was that when these three got up here, they would signal for the rest of the Rangers, about 7 companies, I think, several hundred men, to come up and support them, help them. Well, they were so late getting that the other people decided that they hadn't gotten up here, so they went on with the main attack, the infantry attack, straight into inland. So these people, though, finally, with the greatest difficulty, climbed this cliff.
I think somebody back at headquarters said when this operation was first described to the operations people, he looked with horror at them and said, why, 3 old ladies with brooms could sweep the Rangers off that cliff.
Well, of course, the German had to look a number of places. He didn't know exactly where these people were coming up. Now, they had different types of mortar that shot big grapnel hooks up here. Then they got up ladders and so on, and finally they got up here and took this point. And once one of them got up with an automatic rifle, he could drive the others away, you see. In just a few minutes, those fellows were up here because they were regular monkeys in climbing. There weren't very many Germans here because these big guns, which had been spotted and photographed, were hauled back about 1,200 yards into a woods or an orchard and concealed there. Well, the Rangers got that far and destroyed these guns. This was getting now toward afternoon, and the Germans began to counterattack. We came in here with about 225 Rangers. About 30 or 40 of them were killed or wounded in doing the climb up. And so they would say, whole 180 to start with. Well, they got these counterattacks, and no one could help them. The other people were tied down there, and of course there was no one attacking here on this side. And they were under counterattack for several hours and really held out for 2 days. And when they finally were rescued by the infantry coming along here on the 2nd Battalion of the 115th Infantry, 16th Infantry, there was 90 of them left. But they were still, as far as they were concerned, good shape, and they did their job. It was a very dramatic piece of personal courage, that's what it was.
Suppose we go along and look at Omaha Beach.
Well, I think we should, because there's where the big attack, and that was the one that ran into real resistance. All along the line, that was the worst.
Omaha Beach, directly fronting on the English Channel, was the center of the Allied attack. Its high ground gave every advantage to the enemy. General Eisenhower and I stopped to inspect a German observation post that overlooked that beach.
General, from this bunker overlooking the beaches, the German must have had a tremendous sight on D-Day morning.
Yes, one German observation officer was supposed to have said, my goodness, I just looked out and seen all the ships that there are in the world out there. Probably the fog lifted a little bit, you know, and it came just as all the sudden thing like on a screen. And it was just, it was unbelievable when you saw all of these things put together.
General, from the German officers who you've talked to since the war and the memoirs you've read, what is your version of what happened back there at command headquarters when these fellows up here in the bunkers began calling back the reports?
Well, of course, one of them was unbelief. Unbelief because of the weather. Second, unbelief because their communications were so badly cut up. It was a complete state of confusion for the high command for the moment. Rundstedt didn't know what was happening, and of course all of these division commanders along the line, they knew less, and Mount Rommel wasn't here for the moment.
General, do you think that if Marshal Rommel had not left the front on June 5th to either visit his wife in Stuttgart on her birthday, which happened to be June 6th, or to see Hitler, which was sort of the official version of where he was going, do you think that his presence here would have made a great deal of difference?
No, I don't. He couldn't have known any more than these people did. Now, he was a great believer that the invasion had to be hit right at the beach. And he might have put a more prompt counterattack somewhere, but he couldn't have done it in great strength because he didn't know where his own troops were, what they were doing, and what we were doing.
General Eisenhower then drove me along the now empty expanse of Omaha Beach. Landing at low tide and having to run across this sand exposed the invasion force to heavy German gunfire. But Eisenhower told me it just had to be done that way.
Well, the only trouble was this whole beach had been, Rommel had just sown it with obstacles, every kind of miserable, vicious obstacle, and most of them were mine. Therefore, if you'd have tried to come in here with these ships, we'd just all been blown up or had ourselves, stabbed in the bottom and sunk. And so we had to have this low tide in order to get at this business. And that's exactly what we figured.
Well, General, was it these underwater obstacles that made Omaha the toughest of the beaches, as it was?
Well, of course, that was one part of it, but this beach was very heavily fortified and manned. For example, there were four batteries of field artillery in here, and there were 85 machine gun nests, to say nothing of all of the concrete fortifications, some of which still remain. There were eight big bunkers, each of which had a 75 gun or more, and with a local support for that gun. And there were 35 pillboxes, each of which had guns at all the range from machine guns up to 88 millimeters. They had, I think it was 18 anti-tank guns, and finally there were rocket launchers, launcher sites. I forget how many of those, but say, I think it was about 20.
All of that over how long a stretch of beach?
The beach is about, the total beach we were attacking was about 4 miles. And, but the, area we had to cover, that is the sector for this 5th Corps that was attacking through here, which was the 29th Infantry and the 1st Infantry, stretched out finally to about 10 miles.
Well, now, what was the chronology of D-Day morning here? The troops hit the beach here about what time?
Well, they hit the beach, as I recall, about 7:25. That's what they're supposed to. And we were trying to get a simultaneous beaches. I think down in the British sector, General Montgomery found it necessary because of rocky beaches to shift the time just a little bit. But by and large, they were supposed to get in here about 7:30. But then I think the support ships started firing about 6:30. You must remember, Waller, that all of this sand was filled with obstacles, and there had been some attempts to cut the lanes that we wanted through them, but it wasn't very successful. So out behind that, we were loading equipment and hoping to get it in. For example, the swimming tanks that we wanted to have to lead the attack, there were, out of one group of 28 of them, 20 of them were just turned over and drowned at the bottom of the ocean. Now, some of the men, fortunately, got out, but there's where they were. And of all the artillery, and I forget how many batteries, I think it was three battalions of these, we wanted to get in that day, we got in one battery.
these guns just turned over in this rough weather, and there they were. So everything was gone wrong. It could go wrong. And as I say, finally, the thing that pulled us out was the bravery and the courage and the initiative of the American GI. During the course of the day, this beach got so plugged up that the beachmaster had to tell the new LCIs and LCTs coming in to circle, and they were sort of like milling cattle out there and still getting shot at, and it was just a really terrible situation in this sector. Now, some of them, you remember, had been in these crowded ships for 4 days. Remember, we'd had a 1 day of postponement. So when they came out here, and now they were told, now don't get in your boats yet because we don't know what's going to happen. They were lying in those ships, and those that were in the small boats were even worse because they were getting seasick, and you know, any of us, we get seasick, we just lie down and cry for someone to come and help us out. These people, when they got out of that those things, had to be right at the top of their form. They had to be giving out everything they possibly could to win this battle. So they came in those little ships, and then, of course, finally they would ground. And now you had a long, broad space to come across here, and they had to come, had to wade, some of them, and because even LCTs and LCIs are not riding on top of the water, they're down in the water, couple feet. So they had to wade in, then begin to sprinting, up here to get a place where they could begin shooting. I tell you, it was remarkable that they, under the conditions, they did this well. Now, sometimes they'd lie behind the vehicles that had been disabled, and they would get in little bunches, and then finally they got sick of that because the tide came in. You have a 22-foot tide, remember, and it comes up very quickly, so they were in danger of them drowning. So they got up here. They were under fire all the time, and finally some hardy soul just got up and said, come on, fellas, I'm sick of this, and let's try it. And we began to see these little individual acts of heroism, leadership coming to its very acme, you know, and a fellow starts off with that high ground up there, and they get two or three behind him, they get to become 20 and 30, and finally you've got some real power. And things begin to loosen up.
Did you ever learn who was the man who finally said, let's get off these beaches and get in them?
Well, there was no one here. You see, up until you can get communication with between companies to battalions and battalions to regiments and regiments to your division, there's not much a fellow can do. He doesn't know what's going on. It had to be the local commanders, the platoon leaders and the squad leaders. That was not a general battle, after all. We'd all done all the planning. We thought we had made the best plan that would save the most lives and get the most benefit out of it. But those are the people that had to do the job, and we must never forget that. It was just GI and his platoon and company and squad leaders.
General, was there any thought during the difficult hours of D-Day here on the beach of withdrawing the troops from here?
No, but General Bradley told me later it would have been impossible to have brought these people back and trying to re-embark them in the ships. Matter of fact, their ships were doing something else that time. But what he did begin to study was the possibility of taking his follow-ups, who now couldn't come in here because of the fire and the jam on the beach, and taking some of them into Utah, trying to cut around this whole area and therefore leave it, and some of them possibly even into the British sector, on to the eastward. You must remember, we had an objective. You see that high ground out above there? Now, behind that is a road, and that road runs all the way through to Signe from the right, through Bayou, and to the way on the left, on our left. And that was their objective. And finally, about 3 or 4 in the afternoon, we began to make real penetration. Everything began to loosen up, and we gave a sigh of relief, particularly the commanders on the spot. And by the evening, I don't want to make any mistake, the commanders were ashore.
What were the losses here on Omaha Beach on D-Day?
Well, of course, the first day you couldn't tell by counting the drowned, the killed, the wounded, and some missing. We had over 2,000 casualties on this beach, the Omaha Beach. And these youngsters coming in here paid this terrible price And on this one beach alone, on that one day, it was quite heavy.
It's hard to imagine, looking at this peaceful scene today, that 20 years ago, this beach was what you've just described.
It is almost unreal to look at it today. Everything, the horizon is peaceful, and outside there it's a vacant, and there's no smoke and fire and all the rest of it. But it's a wonderful thing to believe, to remember this is what those fellows were fighting for.
D-Day, of course, was just an important first step. Now that they had this important bit of shoreline, the Allies had to find a way to keep it. Their efforts centered on a Norman resort town called Arromanche.
Well, you know, there's something that armies and navies have known for centuries. When you have a major invasion on a hostile shore, you have to capture a major port very soon. Well, now, one thing that we were quite sure, that while we might capture either Cherbourg, something of that kind, was what we were shooting for, it would probably be destroyed pretty badly, and in the meantime, we were going to need a lot of heavy equipment. And moreover, the English Channel is notorious for its foul weather and uncertain weather, and so it just seemed to be in the cards that we had to do something very soon and very radical. And as far back as 1942, Admiral Mountbatten happened to say to me that, well, you won't have a port, but you will have to make one. Well, this sounded to me rather fantastic, but actually, somewhere in early 43, the British particularly began to think of this problem very seriously. And the Prime Minister interested himself in it, and so they conceived this idea of building artificial harbors, too. One for the American side over on the west, and the other one for the British here in front of Arromanche. Now, this one, of course, turned out to be very successful, and you see the remains of it all the way around. And that was roughly 7 miles from this end, all around through that whole file of breakwaters that they built out there. They built piers that went up and down with the tide, which is very high here, you know, 21 feet, something like that. And they had to have flexible bridges. So the whole thing was a very masterly conception, and the actual completion of the thing was almost miraculous.
With their beachhead established, the next task for Allied forces was to move inland toward the heart of France. It would be no easy feat to get past the many hedgerows that dotted the Norman countryside, that hid the Germans and were heavily defended by them. Breaking through required some GI ingenuity.
This attack in this hedgerow country was terrific, because here, let's say this field would be 50 yards square. You'd try to take men and sneak along the hedges to get behind the defenders of the next hedge. Well, on either side, they'd be flanked by the riflemen. So you just had your tanks to get in there with these light guns, couldn't knock them out, and they could give you the firepower, and the infantry could get on, and that's the way we finally broke through.
So, you know, one of the biggest problems correspondents had in Normandy during the battle was explaining how a hedgerow could stop a 30 or 35-ton tank, because people at home thought of a hedge as the kind of hedge they have, but not like this.
Just stop here a minute, Walter, and I'll just show you how this thing worked. Here's the hedgerow, and it's not really a hedge, it's a bank of earth. And frequently, this is 4 feet thick, 5 feet thick, and often 4 feet tall, and the hedge grows right out of that thing. So that your tank, it can go through the hedge all right, but when it does, it bellies up, you see, and its guns are pointing straight into the sky, and so the fellow's anti-tank guns can just go right through that soft underside of the tank and just put you out of action. Now, the problem had bothered us for some weeks. And finally, a little sergeant in an ordnance department, his name was Kulin, and he had an idea. All it was in the world was to took a tank, and with welding a bar on there, they welded then little plows. It just cut off this bank as you went into it. And this kept your tank right square level, guns blazing when the next hedgerow, which is only 50 yards away. And on top of that,
You really carried some of your own camouflage with you as you went through the thing. This idea very quickly got into the very top echelon, to General Bradley, to be specific. He took a look at this man's homemade model, and he just went ecstatic, proving that the Army brass is not always just Colonel Blimps. Now, this was before we made our breakout on July 25th and captured St. Lo. And I can't, but I think for the assault battalions, at least, we had two out of every three tanks had these things on. And this thing was really a godsend to us. And by the way, Sergeant Kulin later lost a leg in the war and was invalided home.
Why didn't our intelligence tell us about this hedgerow problem so we could prepare in advance for it?
Well, because no one had ever before really had tried to attack through these hedgerows, and no one had thought of it. And remember this, we didn't expect to make a blitz down through these things anyway. On the left of the whole line, we expected that the British Army would be down in the open ground behind Falaise. This would make it easier for us to get down to St. Lo, and it was only then we were going to start our wheel to the Seine, to the left, you see. Well, actually, what happened, because of the tremendous defense the Germans put in around Caen, we finally had to start from way back at St. Lo and swing from there. But then that swinging around movement with just a whole effort to capture the German 7th Army sprung up from the fact that they didn't want to give up that line, so they began to attack right into our hinge. And that gave us a big opportunity, and Bradley, I think, probably thought of the idea first and said, let's swing in closer and capture these fellows right here, and we won't have to fight them on the Seine. And I say, you go right ahead, that's fine. As we closed these armies, one on the other, the British on the north and the Americans coming around from the right, the Germans tried to get out. And, of course, we brought to bear all of our air, all of our machine gun fire and artillery. And, you know, the soldiers began to speak of that as a great killing ground. I think the battle ended, as I recall, about August 16th or 17th, and I went in there about 2 or 3 days later. And during all the acres and acres, it was just nothing but dead. It was a horrible scene. And it was the end of the Normandy campaign. From then on, it was exploitation right up to the Rhine, almost, or up to the borders of Germany.
Thousands of brave men who gave their lives on the coast of Normandy remained there, buried in the American cemetery at Saint Laurent, overlooking Omaha Beach.
Richard Volbrock, Illinois, comrade in arms known only to God, an unknown soldier. Ephraim Lowe of Pennsylvania, New Jersey, I guess. Chester Tenhagen
of
Virginia.
What unit is that man?
86th Battalion, Claude Cole, 90th Division of Arizona. Joseph Slovak of Pennsylvania, 29th Division.
One of the assault divisions.
Russell Woodward of the 29th, and Harry Ramsey of the 8th from New Jersey. Willard Klaus, 82nd Airborne from Kentucky.
Oh, yes.
I think there's some 9,000 boys who fly here. I guess most of the casualties from D-Day are here at Saint Laurent, overlooking Omaha Beach.
All except those that were taken home. About 60% of them were taken home.
Oh.
They're identifiable. Yeah.
And of the unidentified, there are some here, and then there are the names of the missing, of course,
missing,
in the monument.
Yes, that's, and of course, all the unidentified are here.
1,500 missing who never were found from this.
That's called
area.
The Garden of the Missing over there, and the names are all in the on the walls on the other corner of the cemetery.
This cemetery, Saint Laurent, includes all the D-Day casualties, most of those back in through the Normandy fighting, I suppose.
Up until we broke out. That's when the quartermaster put these temporary cemeteries in. They were gathered in here by the American Battle Monuments Commission up as far as down San Lo and in that area, the breakout.
And, of course, this is just one of the cemeteries that stretch from Well, from here around the world, really.
Walter, this D-Day has a very special meaning for me, and I'm not referring merely to the anxieties of the day, the anxieties that were a natural part of sending in an invasion where you knew that many hundreds of boys were going to give their lives or be maimed forever. But my mind goes back so often to this fact. On D-Day, my own son graduated from West Point. And after his training with his division, he came over with the 71st Division, but that was some time after this event. But on the very day he was graduating, these men came here, British and our other allies, Americans, to storm these beaches for one purpose only. Not to gain anything for ourselves, not to fulfill any ambitions that America had for conquest, but just to preserve freedom, systems of self-government in the world. Many thousands of men have died for ideals such as these. And here again, in the 20th century, for the second time, Americans, along with the rest of the free world, but Americans had to come across the ocean to defend those same values. Now, my own son has been very fortunate. He has had a very full life since then. He is a father of four lovely children that are very precious to my wife and me. But these young boys, so many of them, over whose graves we have been treading, looking at, wondering and contemplating about their sacrifices. They were cut off in their prime. They have families that grieve for them, but they never knew the great experiences of going through life like my son can enjoy. I devoutly hope that we'll never again have to see such scenes as these. I think and hope, pray, that the humanity has learned more than we had learned up to that time. But these people gave us a chance, and they bought time for us so that we can do better than we have before. So every time I come back to these beaches, or any day when I think about that day, 20 years ago now, I say once more, we must find some way to work to peace and to really to gain an eternal peace for this world.
8.5 years after D-Day, Dwight Eisenhower became President of the United States. The interviews you just saw took place after he left office. Of course, the usual way to address a man who has served in the White House is Mr. President. Eisenhower may have been the only president for whom that title was insufficient. The world as we know it might not exist today had it not been for the success of D-Day and the wisdom of General Eisenhower. I'm Walter Cronkite.